Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. You're confident when it comes to your work and life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same confidence when it comes to refinancing your existing mortgage or buying a home. It lets you understand all the details so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's hard to get your head around the new healthcare bill the Senate is trying and trying again to pass until it directly impacts you or a loved one. Parents, teachers, doctors who take care of children with disabilities are raising an alarm because the Senate bill will cut support for several million children who depend on government help to live their lives. This hour on Point, the Senate Health Plan and America's Disabled Children. You can join us on air or online. Do you get government help to support a disabled child in your family? How could the Senate bill as it now stands change your special needs child's life? Do you support the Senate's cuts as necessary medicine overdue for a hugely expensive program? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll go to San Antonio, Texas, home of the world's first totally disabled-friendly water park. But first, joining me from Washington is Jordan Rau, senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. He's been reporting on this story, and you can find a link to his story on our website, onpointradio.org. Jordan, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
How did we get this far into the debate over the Senate's version of the House-passed health plan without hearing some hue and cry about the changes to Medicaid and their particular effect on families that depend on support from Medicaid?
Advocates for children on Medicaid have been active, even bringing some of the younger kids to the halls of Congress to press their case. And that is one of the reasons I think that the Senate, when they came up with their bill, they created a special exemption from the changes that they're making to Medicaid for disabled children. So while the majority of people on Medicaid, they would be changing the way that those medical bills are paid and basically just giving states a lump sum per person, the Senate created an exemption for blind and disabled children, children with special needs, in which they would continue to be paid under the current method, which is basically, you know, they would go to the doctor and the doctor would have a bill and the state and the federal government would pay that bill at a set rate.
Out of the total population of special needs, high needs children, many of whom have parents who are employed, making a living, but use Medicaid as their secondary insurance, how many are affected or left out in the carve-out for blind and disabled children? It's my understanding that it won't extend coverage to this entire population.
Right, that's right. So first, about 44% of kids with special needs are on Medicaid. It's a very large number, and we're talking an estimated 5 to 6 million kids of those. And the language of the Senate bill makes it sound like everyone was going to be exempted, all those kids. But in reality, the definition that they're using is very strict, and only about 1.2 million of those kids would be part of the exemption. So there's another, you can do the math, but, 4 million or so that would be the states would get a capped amount for them. And they basically break down into two groups. The majority of them are kids from families with low incomes. But there's also about 400,000 kids from working class or middle class families that normally wouldn't qualify for Medicaid. But over the years, the states have expanded their Medicaid program to include these kids because their disabilities are so severe that if they didn't get serious medical help in the form of physical therapy, occupational therapy, aides to watch them, nurses at school, they might very well end up in an institution. And so those kids, when the fiscal constraints start coming on the states, those kids are probably most at risk for having that expansion rescinded. And those families would not have this extra medical coverage, which, as you say, goes far beyond what even some of the best private insurance covers.
That's Jordan Rao from Kaiser Health News. Jordan, let me bring in another voice right now. Lanhee Chen is one of the key expert voices out there speaking on behalf of the GOP's efforts to pass a health care bill. He's a fellow at the Hoover Institution and teaches public policy and law at Stanford, and he joins us from Stanford. Lanhee Chen, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Good to be with you.
Help us understand how this got in there in the first place, both by politics and optics and also by money. This would seem to present problems to a Senate that's still trying to pull the public on board for the passage of this bill.
Well, this is a very difficult set of reforms just in terms of explaining them, because there are so many different pieces interacting. So to step back for a moment, the idea behind the vast majority of the reforms to Medicaid, as you've implied, is to make the program sustainable for beneficiaries of the program in the long run. But it's a little bit more complicated than that. The idea of putting Medicaid on a system of what are known as per capita caps actually originated with President Bill Clinton in the 1990s, when the Medicaid program was initially seen to be having some fiscal issues. President Clinton and the Democrats in Congress actually proposed this exact idea, which was to take Medicaid and essentially delegate out by group payments for Medicaid services, the idea being that the program would remain an entitlement. In other words, people who fell into those groups, the aged, the disabled, the blind, many of the kids that you're talking about, would continue to retain Medicaid as an entitlement, but the spending on that program would be capped at the federal level. Now, fast forward 20-some-odd years. Here we are in 2017. The Republicans have put the same proposal, in essence, into their Senate bill. And what they've tried to do is to retain in many ways the entitlement aspect for those groups, for the aged, the blind, the disabled, so-called dual eligibles, for example, people who are on Medicare and Medicaid. They would retain the entitlement to Medicaid, but spending on Medicaid would be changed. The financing structure would be changed. Now, the specific issue we're talking about here, which is kids who have some special need, the idea there was to exclude them entirely from the system of caps. So in other words, they would retain the current Medicaid financing system. The challenge that senators ran into, though, was trying to identify exactly who those kids were. So what they used in the bill, what they've used in the discussion draft so far, is a proxy of some sort, which is basically any child that's part of the Social Security Disability Insurance Program or who receives what's known as Supplemental Security Insurance, SSI, through the Social Security program, they would be exempt from these so-called per capita caps. The challenge is, of course, as Jordan and others have pointed out, is that there are a number of kids who don't fall into that definition but who also are disabled. The issue is, how do we get the assistance to them that they need? And I think that's something that senators are going to have to work on in terms of other definitions. The point that a lot of Senate staff will make is that we don't actually know how many kids fall into this category. We have a sense. We have surveys that have been done by private sources, but there's no good government data on this. So one of the things the Senate bill does is to mandate that states report, beginning in 2019, that they report exactly how many kids are of special needs, and so we can get a better sense to target the assistance that's necessary in the long run.
Soo Jung Kim's 11-year-old daughter Alice needs a lot of different treatments for her rare neurological condition. Kim described her daughter's symptoms to the Washington Post.
She's nonverbal. She can't walk. She can't use her hands. She can't chew.
Right.
She has developed seizure disorder, scoliosis, respiratory complications, and there's no cure right now.
Lanhee Chen, are we facing the possibility of rescinding or capping or cutting coverage to some subset of these children and then finding out afterwards who's in need and reintroducing them to the program?
Well, first of all, the Senate is still trying to figure out exactly what they do with these changes to Medicaid. Now, one of the things the Senate could do, for example, is they could create a more generous growth of this cap over time, particularly for kids specifically, regardless of whether they're special needs or not. They could say, look, all kids the growth rate of this cap is going to be more generous. That is something potentially that could address the vast majority of these issues. The other thing I would say, there's two other things I would say. One is ultimately what happens to various programs is a state-level determination, not a federal one. So states have it within their authority and power to make decisions regarding the structure of programs for special needs kids, what services are provided, and ultimately the generosity of those packages is something that states are able to calibrate based on what they're doing in their budgets. Now, obviously, federal funding plays a part in that, which is why I suggested it's possible for the Senate to make that per capita cap more generous. But that's something that they're going to have to figure out here as they negotiate the final elements of the deal. The other thing I would just say briefly is I think a lot of reporting on this has been wrong in the sense that people refer to the changes to the Medicaid program and the potential reductions in spending against what's happening today as a function of the transition to this per capita cap system. That's actually not right. The vast majority of the reduction in spending has to do with able-bodied adults coming off the Medicaid expansion that was created by the Affordable Care Act, not changes to programs for the disabled or for the kinds of kids we're talking about here. In fact, the CMS actuary, the person within the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services that estimates the impact of policy changes has said that the per capita cap conversion itself, the change to this kind of financing structure, actually only results in a change of about 1% of overall Medicaid spending over the next 10 years. So we have to be very careful in our reporting for those that are reporting and very careful in our analysis of this bill because it is very complex.
We have a very careful reporter with us, Jordan Rao. Is this attracting enough attention, Jordan, that it could scuttle the whole deal as currently formulated?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. And, you know, I hate to punt on this one, but I've just sort of given up on predicting what's going to happen because my profession has been so not on the ball on that. I think that this is an issue that obviously a bunch of the senators, including Orrin Hatch, who's the chair of the Finance Committee, were concerned enough about to put in the bill. So I think there's a good chance that they may come up with some change, but you know, we'll have to see what they do.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. With Rocket Mortgage, you can apply simply and understand fully so you can mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the huge role, who knew, that Medicaid plays in helping families with disabled children, and the Senate's proposals, which could leave several million of those children out of the coverage, at least temporarily. You can join the conversation. Are you surprised by the politics, by the optics of Senate Republicans cutting aid to disabled children? Do you think this falls into the category of who knew health care was so complicated? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests are Lanhee Chen, a fellow at the Hoover Institution, one of the experts speaking on behalf of the GOP's efforts to pass a new health care bill, Jordan Rao, senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. And now, Sarah Bachman joins me in the studio. She's a professor at the Center for Innovation in Social Work and Health at Boston University and the principal investigator in the National Center for Health Insurance and Financing for Children and Youth with Special Health Care Needs. Sarah, often called Sally, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
There are competing imperatives here, giving service to people whose costs would be ruinous, and bending the cost curve on one of the most expensive things that the federal government does, of all the things that the federal government does. How do you meld these two imperatives?
The Medicaid program, since its inception, has faced this tension of trying to be effective and efficient with limited resources and also meet the needs of many people who do not have the income to provide for the health care that they need without some additional support. The Medicaid program now covers about 40% of all U.S. children. And the funding for Medicaid comes from both state and federal governments. States supply 50%, up to 50% of the funding for Medicaid. But in some states, such as Mississippi, the federal government covers 75% of those costs. It's a lot of money for states to make up.
There are children, I was reading to prepare for this program, with maladies and conditions that are vanishingly rare. We're talking about a few hundred people in the United States have them. Chromosomal disorders, one-off kinds of musculoskeletal things. Yet, this is a tremendously expensive program to fund at the same time. We're talking about sometimes children who have things that there are only a few peers in the United States, and yet we're also talking about big, big money to keep them comfortable, to keep them alive, to keep them involved in their families' lives.
Mm-hmm. Children with disabilities, children with special health care needs, are thriving longer than they ever have in the past, thanks to medical technology, improvements in the healthcare that we're able to provide, and the fact that we can keep many children at home, which is where we want children to be. The advances in medical technology cost a lot of money. And in order for that technological improvement curve to continue, we need to pay for that. And there's a huge industry around that, both the development of the technologies, children's hospitals, where children with these special healthcare needs are treated. And we have invested in this to the great benefit of children and families.
Lonnie Chen, do we have to worry about false economies here, where, as Sally Bachman suggests, one of the things we accomplish by extending this aid is keeping young people out of hospitals, which are far more expensive than having them at home and having a health aide clean out the machines that help them breathe, maintain the machines that provide some movement and therapy? Are we taking a risk of cutting some very expensive programs and then ending up on the hook for even more money?
Ray, I think it is important to understand that in the healthcare system, when you talk about healthcare spending, there are always trade-offs. And certainly, we want to be delivering care in the most effective, most cost-efficient way possible. Now, it is the case that in many situations, care in the home is a far better, far more impactful way to deliver care than in a facility, than in a hospital. It's also, frankly, much more cost-efficient. So we do want to be careful about that. But one thing I would say is that the Medicaid program, if you ask a governor, what is one thing that you would like to see in your Medicaid program? Now, aside from more money, I think every governor would always love to see more money in the Medicaid program. The one thing they'll tell you almost universally is they'd love to see more flexibility in the program. They'd love to see fewer dictates from Washington and more opportunities for them to innovate and engage in the kinds of value-based purchasing, the kinds of really kind of creative solutions that I think a lot of states are availing themselves of. And so the question is, how can we deliver care? How can we give states the opportunity to deliver that care that's needed to disabled populations, to kids with special needs, to those who are old and frail, those who are aged and blind? How do we ensure that the Medicaid program is working for those states and giving them the flexibility they need? I think one of the things that this bill, that the GOP Senate bill tries to do, and we'll see if it actually does it, if it passes, is to give states some measure of that flexibility precisely so they can deliver the care to populations that's needed. And again, a lot of this is going to fall to the states to determine how best to deliver that care, because really what the federal government does currently under Medicaid is set guidelines and rules on Medicaid and provide some percentage of funding for it.
Jordan Rao, you're tasked with helping the public understand what's at stake. How do you navigate those choppy waters between explaining what is a cut, what's a cap, when in fact budgets that increase are not, strictly speaking, a cut, but when we understand that the cost of providing some of these services is going to go up year on year on year, eventually it will mean less service, less care for some of these individuals?
Yeah, it's super important to be clear about these things. And a lot of this stuff is extremely technical when you're talking about, you know, medical inflation, consumer price inflation, and all the different metrics that they use. So, you know, I think we try and do the best that we can to both explain the various causes that are why Medicaid and some of these other health programs are projected to have such large increases, and also explain the difference between what's under the current law from the ACA, how much would be spent versus how much less basically would be spent under the various Republican proposals.
It's important to also understand that in state budgets, Medicaid is typically the largest line item, and it's an average of 28% of state budgets all in. But about two-thirds of that comes from the federal government. States are supporting only about one-third of that total cost because that's all they can afford. Also, states have a tremendous amount of flexibility already and have been gaining more flexibility in terms of the use of waivers and other mechanisms in the Medicaid program to allow states to structure the Medicaid program that works for them.
We'll go first to Akron, Ohio. Kate's on the line. Kate, welcome to On Point.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. What's up, Kate?
Well, the reason I was calling is because I'm a parent of one of the children you mentioned earlier. My son, we believe he has a genetic disorder, but he's had the whole exome testing, and they can't find exactly what gene causes his problems. But he's received a lot of services. My husband and I are both teachers, and when he was younger, we didn't make a whole lot of money. And so there's a Medicaid program that actually picks up where our employer insurance leaves off. And that was what allowed us to continue to pay for our home, stay in our home, and be a family together. So if these services are cut, we're going to see families who are working families of children with special needs who are going to be torn apart, or those children are going to have impact on their health where they're not going to get the support that they need. My son also inspired me to become a special education teacher since he was born. And I work with students who typically have visual impairments but often have a lot of other medical concerns. And some of those students fully rely on Medicaid just for the things that keep them alive. And if they go without even for a year, that can mean the difference between their families becoming homeless or them going without things that they need to stay healthy. So I just wanted to give that perspective as both a parent and educator. There is one other element I wanted to speak about in terms of education, and that is the fact that schools are reimbursed by Medicaid for some of the services that are provided in school, such as OT and PT, which the students get so that they can better access their curriculum in the school. And if those cuts are made, schools are going to have to make up for that money in some way, whether it's cutting back on the special needs student services or cutting back on things that affect all students.
Kate, thanks a lot for your call. Home and school, Sally Bachman. This is a universal wraparound set of services.
Yes, it takes a village to raise a child, and particularly so for children with special health care needs. Families will do almost anything it takes to make sure that their child is thriving. One of the things that doesn't get talked about very much is family financial hardship, as we've been discussing. The data show that families cut back on work or quit work altogether in order to provide services to their child with special health care needs. This really has a negative impact on the economy. Not only are families not able to work and access private health care coverage through their employer, they also then sink into poverty and become dependent on the very program that we're talking about cutting. So children need supports in all the settings that you find children, and you want children to be at home, at school, with their peers, having a higher quality of life. That also helps families to be participating in the economic engine.
Lisa is with us now from Austin, Texas. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi, Ray. This
Hi.
Is a topic I'm really passionate about as the mother of a child with a disability. I would like to address something Mr. Chen said, that senators are basing information on existing SSI and Medicaid waiver recipients. Texas has a 14-year-long wait list. So that's approximately, I think it was 150,000 to 160,000 people that are waiting for services. So it's really skewed data that isn't accurate about the need. And I think that the whole GOP narrative that states will take care of their vulnerable citizens is erroneous. Texas has cut Medicaid to medically fragile children at every turn. They've also limited therapies that kids can receive. And Texas actually had an illegal cap on special education services in place for 12 years. It was just overturned in order to save money. So cumulatively, to me, that means that in Texas's state, it will not take care of its vulnerable citizens. And while we are on a for-profit insurance, it will completely exclude this population. My family uses private insurance because we earn just too much to qualify for any help, but not enough to actually afford it comfortably. We live on an incredibly tight budget. There is no room, no wiggle room. And frankly, the future for my son, if we remain in this state, worries me because there's not any transitional services. There's not a lot of vocation options. There's not a lot of living opportunities for people with disabilities. Again, there's a wait list.
So your son is 10 now. You're looking ahead to when he's 20 and 30.
Correct.
Lonnie Chen, what do you have to say to Lisa in Austin?
Yeah, she raises some very good points. So let me just say, first of all, she's absolutely right about us not having very good data because states oftentimes aren't able to report accurately on the number of, for example, kids with special needs that they're serving. So I think one of the things we do need to do over the next few years, certainly I think this is something that the Senate bill tries to do, is to get states to give us some of that information so that we can more accurately estimate exactly what the needs are. The other thing I would say is that the Medicaid expansion created by the Affordable Care Act, what a lot of people don't realize is this. The payments that the federal government is sending to states under the Medicaid expansion are more generous for the able-bodied adult expansion population than they are for the traditional Medicaid populations. Pretty much all of the kids that we're talking about fall into the traditional Medicaid population. So you have kids that have special needs. This also extends, by the way, to the aged and the disabled. Essentially, what the Medicaid expansion of the Affordable Care Act did is to create this perverse incentive for states to provide benefits at a more generous level for people who are coming in through the Medicaid expansion. So, adults, let's say, who previously did not qualify, but who the Affordable Care Act expanded qualification for. What the bill actually did, what the Affordable Care Act did, was to provide benefit levels, funding levels, at a more generous point for those people than for the traditional Medicaid population. So one of the things that a Medicaid reform needs to think about doing going forward, whether it's the Republican bill or something else, frankly, is to create an equalization in funding. So either increasing the level of funding provided to traditional Medicaid populations or decreasing, frankly, the level of funding provided to the expansion population to address this fundamental inequity that the Affordable Care Act created.
Sally Bachman?
Historically, block grants, which whether we call it a per capita cap or we call it a block grant, are the same thing, essentially capping the revenues that come from the federal government to the states. Historically, these types of financing arrangements have resulted in about 25% cuts in the total amount of funding that's available. So we're not just rearranging the dollars from one eligibility group to another. We're talking about serious and significant cuts to the Medicaid program.
And Jordan Rau, a patchwork quilt of the kind of benefits you can rationally expect to receive depending on where you live in the United States.
Yeah, the Medicaid program, unlike Medicare, greatly varies. And you do have states like Texas that have been very, I don't mean this pejoratively, but tight-fisted on their benefits. And then you have some other states that have expanded them dramatically. And so that's created a great difficulty for the federal government. And as Lonnie said, the thrust of this bill is putting both a lot of the decisions back on the states and also the financial responsibilities for picking up whatever they want. But you could really see a case where, much more so than today, from state to state, there's a dramatic difference in what is covered.
Where are the lowest reimbursement and lowest level of support states. Which ones are they?
I'll defer to the experts on that one. But in general, I think that you can generally say the bluer the state, more generous the benefits.
Okay.
And vice versa for the reds.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the surprising hit millions of disabled children around the country might take with the Senate health care bill now being hammered out. You can join the conversation. Is this simply the duty of a civilized society to cover the neediest children? My guests are Lonnie Chen, a fellow at the Hoover Institution, Jordan Rao, senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News, and Sally Bachman, here with me in Boston, a principal investigator in the National Center for Health Insurance and Financing for Children and Youth with Special Health Care Needs. Laura is with us now from Odessa, Florida. Laura, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
I'm a social worker here in the great state of Florida. And I just have a comment about the eligibility that children go through to qualify for our federal program, Social Security Disability. In the disability system, it's again very complicated like healthcare. A child can be extremely disabled. However, the eligibility for services is based on the parent's income or the family income. So if a family makes slightly above the poverty level, they do not qualify for those services for their children. However, if they qualify, if they are below that level, then they could receive a sum of money per month, around $700, and their child would then receive the Medicaid benefit. That could be for a very minimal disability, such as a slight speech delay, which those services are typically given in schools at no cost. In the state of Florida, I've seen over my 30 years that the childhood disability income has been a replacement for the welfare system, which I think is very unfair. I think that it is complicated, but we have a great model in the Veterans Administration where disabilities are assessed on a percentage basis, and that may be a better system for childhood disabilities so that families who do have a higher income would also qualify when the child has a severe disability.
Sally Bachman and then Lonnie Chen.
Laura, thank you for bringing up this point, and I appreciate hearing from a social worker. I just want to add to the conversation what these income levels are. So children who live in families that have income at roughly 100% of the federal poverty level are the children who are eligible for SSI and the children who would be in this carve-out arrangement. So I want to add to the conversation that the income that we're talking about is about $20,000 for a family of three, a little bit more than that. So you can see that it's very easy for children and families to fall into this category that Laura is describing, that families have income that's above this very stringent level of 100% of the federal poverty level.
And Lonnie Chen, I wonder if you're made poor, even if not on paper, but made poor by the phased out services that happen when you are making, admittedly, not a lot of money.
Yeah, this is a challenge that we have in designing any healthcare system, which is that you've got folks that are really on that cusp of eligibility for a program, whether it's a state program or federal program. And what's the best way to ensure that they have a package of benefits that helps them through whatever medical conditions they're dealing with? And part of what we need to do as a healthcare system, this is not a comment on the Republican bill specifically, but just generally what we need to do as a healthcare system is figure out how to better manage that so-called churn between the Medicaid program and between private insurance for people who are working, let's say, multiple jobs, for example, and may have an offer of employer insurance through one of those jobs? How do we ensure that that insurance is affordable? And how do we ensure that they get access to the services they need if they slip below a certain level? These are all really difficult questions. I did want to make a revision on a couple things we were talking about earlier. First of all, the notion that block grants and per capita caps, which are kind of some of the reforms in the Senate bill, are the same is actually quite far from the truth. The reality is that the programs are very different. And in fact, we fought many political battles in the 1990s over the difference between the two. What the Senate bill tries to do right now is to retain the entitlement structure of Medicaid. In fact, this is why some conservatives are quite upset, because what the Republican bill actually does is to retain the entitlement aspect of Medicaid by ensuring that different groups are funded at different levels and to retain that structure of Medicaid itself. Also, the question of where federal financing is most generous in the Medicaid program actually is entirely the opposite from what Jordan said. In the blue states, the federal government actually picks up the least amount of the tabs. So California, for example, the federal government pays 50%. New York, New Jersey, a lot of blue states, the federal government actually pays a much smaller share than in many red states like Alabama, where the federal share is higher, about 70% in Alabama. So it's quite interesting, the dynamic that's going on there.
No, but the state picks up more money, and as a total benefit, you are going to collect – you're going to have a more solid benefit in Massachusetts than you are in Mississippi. It may come from different places, but the
question, Ray, was the level of federal financing. So I just wanted to make the point.
No,
clear.
It was the level of state support.
The level of federal financing is higher in red states than blue states.
The level of state support is lower in red states than it is in blue states.
Is that states will make a decision?
Ray on this one. What I was talking about was the benefits that were provided to the people. Lonnie's absolutely right that the richer the state is, the less they get from Medicaid. But that's not what we were talking about when we were talking about the benefits. And the caller, as I recall, was in Texas, which I believe is not as generous in the benefits they provide through Medicaid as a state like California or New York.
We'll make one more stop to hearing from our callers this hour to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Magdalena is with us. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. Thank you very much. I'm calling in as parents of a severely medically fragile child. She will be 19 in August. She became medically fragile as a result of the traumatic brain injury at birth. I see the changes being proposed by this health care bill as extremely devastating. I feel it would be, for lack of a better word, a tsunami in terms of the quality of life for these families and our children. It's a public health professional, middle class, and the state of New Mexico has excellent programs that has helped us, and including all the people on board, professionals who have helped us. Our child is alive because we have support, and our child is cared for at home. She is at the highest level. She cannot speak. She cannot walk. She has oxygen, cannot swallow. All of the levels. And I think one thing that is really, we're talking about the children, but these children are at the top in terms of a pyramid and in terms of what's at the bottom of them, all those who help to push our children forward, give them a quality of life, including us as parents. It really would be a devastating situation and push families to the edge. As a middle-class family, we've been able to provide our child with a quality of life thanks to the Medicaid, Medically Fragile Program, the MEVIA Supplemental Program. It's just amazing the quality of life and that our child has lived to be almost 19 as a result of this situation. And the last thing I'd like to add is that children with severe disabilities, like our daughter Milagro, are able to advance medical knowledge and training in medical hospitals and institutions. So there's a benefit beyond just going for caring for our children. There's a societal benefit that our children contribute to advance the knowledge of society.
Magdalena in Albuquerque, New Mexico, thanks a lot for your call. Let me thank my guests as well. Lonnie Chen is a fellow at the Hoover Institution. He joined us from Stanford. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Jordan Rao is senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. Thanks for your reporting and for your help today.
Good to be here. Thank you very much.
And finally, Sally Bachman, a principal investigator in the National Center for Health Insurance and Financing for Children and Youth with Special Health Care Needs, and a professor at Boston University's School of Public Health. Sally, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
In a moment, the world's first water park for the disabled. This is On Point. San Antonio, Texas is home to a unique theme park, specifically designed, built, and run to make disabled people, and especially disabled children, feel right at home. Joining me now from San Antonio is Gordon Hartman, founder of the amusement park Morgan's Wonderland, and now, just opened, Morgan's Inspiration Island, the world's only ultra-accessible water park. Gordon, a pleasure to talk to you after a lot of tough, complicated, and somewhat discouraging news. Good to have you.
Well, Ray, thank you so much. You're right. After listening to your program, it is somewhat depressing because as a person who's involved with the foundation with assisting those with special needs and hearing much of where we're going with some potential legislation, it's very devastating. So thank you for bringing that to your viewers and listeners.
Let's talk a little bit about the need for the park. Water parks offer a chance for, whatever shape you're in, you're buoyant, you're able to be in the water and paddle around or walk around or roll around. What was missing in a conventional water park that you wanted to include in Inspiration Island?
Well, first what we did, Ray, is we built Morgan's Wonderland back in 2007, which is an amusement park that allowed for rides and for everything to be ultra-accessible, meaning no matter how acute someone's special need may be, that they could enjoy 100% of the park. What we often say is our park is for 100% of the population, not for 87% of the population. As that has grown over the past 7 years, and we've had people from 66 different countries in all 50 states attend Morgan's Wonderland, there was a lot of discussion about why not add water to this concept, to this idea of making it ultra-accessible. And that was basically what started the whole process of planning and ultimately building and now opening Morgan's Inspiration Island. The key to it is that Morgan's Inspiration Island, like Morgan's Wonderland, is not a park just for special needs. It is a park of inclusion. And what that basically says is that everyone can do everything. The word can't is never mentioned in our parks. That is not part of our vocabulary. And that's basically what the magic is of Morgan's Wonderland and Morgan's Inspiration Island. And what we had to do is think through from a water perspective to ensure that children, for example, who may be fragile to tap water conditions, that we would warm the water in certain areas. For children and adults who are in wheelchairs, that we would be able to have wheelchairs that would work specifically for the conditions within the water park. For those who have electronic or battery-operated wheelchairs, we had to come up with a pneumatic wheelchair that basically works off compressed air so they can get wet and do 100% of the activities within the water park. Those are the kind of things that we had to do to make what I refer to as minor adjustments, but by doing those minor adjustments, we were able to add millions, tens of millions of more people to the potential of being able to be a part of the involvement with everyone else, beside everyone else, and being able to enjoy something that otherwise they may not ever have the opportunity to do.
I was interested to see that not only from the amusement park, but from the water park as well, that people who were taking advantage of it not only appreciated the fact that they could do everything, and let's be clear, that was very important to them, but that they could be in an amusement park and not have people looking at them, making them feel like outsiders, that there was a very important this is for us feeling that they had when they arrived on the scene at Morgan's.
Well, that's an excellent point, Ray. You know, the culture of Morgan's Wonderland and Morgan's Inspiration Island is about inclusiveness. And when people come there, three out of four of those who walk through the door do not have special needs. One out of four does. So you have a bringing together everyone. But when they walk through the Welcome Center, they recognize what this park is about, what it represents. And that makes it a calm setting, if you will, an area where everyone, those who have special needs, it's a learning experience for the children and adults within that don't have special needs in their families, but also opens up opportunities that otherwise would not exist for special needs families or for those who have special needs within their families. Because when we're talking about special needs, we're not just talking about the special needs individual. The effects on the family, the brother, the sisters, and all of them now able to join in play together. I mean, I read stories every day through emails and letters that I receive from people who have been to both of these parks about things they've done that they never imagined would be possible, and that's the whole idea behind it. True inclusiveness, but also at the same time, everyone within the involvement of the park at the time in which they were there were fully engaged with them.
Omar Villafranca from CBS News paid a visit last week to Morgan's Inspiration Island and spoke with some of the park's guests.
Disabled guests like 7-year-old Rhea Edison get into the park for free.
This is the first time you've been here?
Yes.
And how many more times do you want to come back this summer?
17.
What is it like to see Hayden in the water just being a 10-year-old kid?
Oh, it's so much fun. He is having such a great time, and making him happy makes me happy.
Gordon Hartman, what led you to this? Why did you get involved in the first place?
Well, I got involved back in 2006 because I was part of watching my daughter who has special needs, who will be 24 in September. I saw her try to interact with some other very nice children in a pool and was basically, because of her verbal inability to say, hey, I like to play, some very nice children grabbed their ball and ran out of the pool quickly. That turned a Morgan to me, and that look on her face of why made me think to myself, well, you know, we can't take her to a lot of other places because they're too crowded, they're just not acceptable. And Morgan's not the exception to the rule. Many children and adults with special needs are not able to go to normal parks and enjoy themselves and be inclusive. That began the whole starting process of Morgan's Wonderland and the building of now Morgan's Wonderland and Morgan's Inspiration Island. Here we are $53 million later, but I can tell you that every bit of the money that has been spent and the hundreds of thousands, millions, over a million people who have been there have recognized that it truly makes a difference. People have done things they never thought they could do. They've come from all over the world to be a part of something that does not exist anywhere else. And our hope is, Ray, that not only are we doing that here in San Antonio, but we're seeing now people throughout the country and literally throughout the world wanting to make adjustments to their parks because it's important that not just a percentage of the population enjoy what opportunities others have, but 100% of the population. That was the guiding, and Morgan was the inspiration behind it, but really that was the guiding principle of all of us who worked so hard in being able to make this possible.
Gordon Hartman is founder of the amusement park Morgan's Wonderland and Morgan's Inspiration Island in San Antonio, Texas. Thanks for being with us, Gordon.
Thank you so much, Ray. Appreciate the opportunity.
I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.